your wishes and light your candles today, you should mind, your mind should not just be focused on me as an individual, but rather a proud member of a people being oppressed. And so these are his words since the shooting. When he was in sixth grade in 2015, he wrote, that's Hisham Awartani, "Hope dwells in my heart. It shines like a light in darkness. The light cannot be smothered. It cannot be drowned out by tears and the screams of the wounded. It only grows in strength. This light can outshine hate. This light can outshine injustice. It outshines segregation and apartheid. As of Greek legend, Pandora opened a box. And when she did that, all the evil escaped. But luckily, Pandora closed the jar before hope could escape. And as long as hope stayed in that jar, hope would never escape. So I ask you one thing. Learn from the story. Learn to never give up hope. Learn to let hope give power in the darkness of times. And let the light shine."
Wow. Hisham in sixth grade. And how yes. about Tahsin?
Tahsin, there are two poems. I want to read one, which depicts where our students are coming from, that they are coming from living under a brutal occupation apartheid system that agonizes them, that traumatizes them day in and day out. Children, sixth graders. So Tahsin writes, "My ears are pounding. Children dying, mothers crying, authorities lying. My ears are pounding. My ears are pounding. Missiles destroying, bombs exploding, bullets killing. My ears are pounding. Press careless, dreams traceless, lands ownerless. My ears are pounding. Kids without mothers, beds without covers, Palestine without others. My ears are pounding. My ears are pounding. There is one sound I heard, not from a breeze or a bird, the sound of darkness. My ears are pounding. My ears are pounding. I'd rather be deaf." So I mean, that says a lot. That says a lot about where we are at today and the story of the Palestinian struggle, which is often depicted as that this all started on October 7th. And so this is 2015. And there are, when you read this poem, you feel like you're reading it about today, about our people in Gaza and what they are going through. And yet this is, this was, 8 years ago. So the struggle continues. Yeah.
And Joyce, I wanted to ask you, if you could comment on the tragic irony that the families of the victims have said in various interviews that they thought that the U.S. would be a safer place for their children than the West Bank, and then to have this terrible tragedy occur here.
Yes, of course. I mean, I think that is the absolute truth. We all, you know, I know that a large number of Palestinian students from the Ramallah Friends School attend U.S. colleges, and they're actually very sought after. And when they come here, the parents know that they are keeping them away from being subjected to violence from not just the Israeli military, but the Israeli settlers. I have a 31-year-old son there now, and I worry about his safety. The settlers have been emboldened, and there's violence there every day. And you wonder, you know, you send them here, and then this keffiyeh has now become a symbol instead of our struggle, instead of a symbol of our tradition, our traditional dress, and our struggle. And it, this is now being painted and tainted as a symbol of violence. And so I have another son in Washington, D.C. He doesn't leave home without his keffiyeh. I worry about him too. So that is where we're at right now. And I can't but agree with Wafiq about the dehumanization that has been taking place. And this is not new. You know, Palestinians are, you know, even in our grief, we are depicted as Palestinians dying, right? While Israelis are being killed and massacred. So language really matters. And I think that is what we have seen time and time again. You know, the 47 children died on the West Bank between January and August of this year, way before this war started. And I wonder, like, who cried for them? Who mourned them? Where was the U.S. mainstream media talking about them? And so so it's not just the language, it's also the framing, right? That this is the worst attack since the Holocaust, painting Palestinians as Jew haters, as that this is a religious struggle rather than a people seeking freedom, seeking liberation from a settler colonial system. And remembering, you know, that Palestinians of all faiths are in the same struggle as well, and they have not been offered the humanity and the dignity that they deserve. And so I think this is all manifest due to the continued dehumanization, not only by the media but by our government. You know, as Wafiq said, that they continue to turn a blind eye. They're not calling for a ceasefire. They continue to embolden the Israeli atrocities by sending more aid, doubling their aid, and supporting the genocide of our people. And so that is truly the reason why this is happening. I just wanted to also take the opportunity, you know, we're doing there's this exchange of hostages, and when they talk about that, they talk about Israelis released the Israeli released our children, while the Palestinians who are released are teenagers. So children versus teenagers. You know, in my book, they're all hostages. You know, the fact that the media is not talking about the 3,000 Palestinians who have been kidnapped, basically since the October 10th, and put in Israeli jails, and they're calling them, they're not prisoners. To them, they are bargaining chips, right, that they will use in the exchange. But to us, they are hostages, just like the hostages that are held in Gaza. And so that is the narrative that is being talked about day in and day out. And people who have sentiments that are anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, are emboldened by all of that and take action, like Jason Eaton, who felt emboldened because no one is portraying Palestinians as human beings that deserve the dignity and the respect that everyone else should be that everyone else is granted.
Jason Eaton, of course, is the alleged shooter of the three Palestinian young men. I want to thank you, Joyce Ajluni, the former director of the Ramallah Friends School, where they all went to school in the occupied West Bank. All three students shot in Burlington, Vermont on Friday. Joyce is also now the General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee. And I want to thank Wafiq Faour, a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon, member of Vermonters for Justice in Palestine, speaking to us from Burlington. And this final note is speaking about the Vermont representatives. You have Becca Balint, who is the first Jewish Congress member to call for a ceasefire. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has not called for a ceasefire, but has called for conditions on U.S. aid to Israel. He said, quote, "While Israel has the right to go after Hamas, Netanyahu's right-wing extremist government does not have the right to wage almost total warfare against the Palestinian people." Coming up, we speak to prize-winning investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about Israel's propaganda war over Al-Shifa Hospital and what's underneath it. Who built what's under Shifa Hospital? Back in 20 seconds. Behind by Adnan Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel's continuing to detain the head of Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza. Last week, the Israeli military detained Mohammed Abu Salmiya as he was evacuating patients south from Gaza City. Israel raided Al-Shifa, claiming Hamas ran a command and control center under the hospital, but Israel's yet to provide any hard evidence to back that up. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak recently spoke with CNN's Christian Amanpour. He admitted Israel built the bunkers decades ago underneath Al-Shifa.
It's already known for many years that they have in the bunkers that originally was built by Israeli constructors underneath Shifa was, were used as a command post of the Hamas and a kind of a junction of several tunnels part of the system. I don't know to say to what extent it is a major. It's probably not the only kind of command post. Several others are under other hospitals or in other sensitive places, but it's for sure had been used by Hamas even during this conflict.
Well, when you say it was built by Israeli engineers, did you misspeak?
No, somebody, you know, decades ago, we were running the place. So we held them. It was decades, many decades ago, probably four decades ago, that we helped them to build these bunkers in order to enable more space for the operation of the hospital within the very limited size of this compound.
Again, that was the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak. We're joined now by Jeremy Scahill, senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. One of his most recent pieces for The Intercept is headlined Al-Shifa Hospital, Hamas's Tunnels, and Israeli Propaganda. Jeremy's joining us from Germany. Jeremy, can you talk about what he just said?
Yeah, well, first of all, Amy, the Al-Shifa Hospital, originally going back to the years of the British Mandate in the 1940s, it was a British military barracks, and then it was converted into a hospital. And under both the Israeli and the Egyptian occupations of that area. And then in the 1980s, the Israelis began to do extensive construction on it. In fact, I was looking at the Israeli architecture archives that were set up, and you can go back and look at from that era, and two Tel Aviv architects oversaw the expansion of the Al-Shifa Hospital. And by 1983, they had finished the construction of underground facilities at the hospital. Now, we should also say it's not uncommon for hospitals the world over to have underground facilities for a variety of reasons. But when you're in an active war zone, it's very common. In fact, Israel has many underground facilities at its hospitals throughout Israel and has been using them since October 7th, certainly. They're considered more secure places to hold vulnerable patients. And so what we know about Israel's construction is that they at least built an underground operating room. They built a network of tunnels. And in fact, during some of the construction, the son of one of the Israeli architects who designed the underground facility said that when Israel was building these in the 1980s, they hired people from Hamas as security to guard the construction project so to ensure that it wouldn't get attacked.
And Jeremy, could you talk also about the thousands of prisoners that Israel has been holding, many of them without any trial for extended years, and yet the Netanyahu government refers to all of them as terrorists?
Yeah, I mean, Juan, I went through, and this connects also to the narrative around Al-Shifa, but just to directly answer your question, Israel released a list of 300 names that it said were fair game for a hostage prisoner handover because of the truce with Hamas. And I went through all 15 pages of those names. I read each of the individual dates of birth, the dates of arrest, what the nature of the charges were, if there were any charges. Some of them don't even list any actual charges against them. And what I discovered is that of the 300 names, 233 of these prisoners, most of them are teenage boys. Some are there's a teenage girl who's 15 years old. The 233 of 300 have not been convicted of anything. They haven't been sentenced for anything. And Israel is the only country in the so-called developed world that tries children in military courts. And so, you know, the Israeli narrative is that these are all hardened terrorists because Palestinians are not allowed to have any context. Palestinians are not treated as full human beings. So when a child, maybe his brother was killed by the Israeli forces, maybe his mother was killed by the Israeli forces, throws a rock at a soldier, their houses are often then raided at night, they're snatched, they're taken to interrogation without the presence of a parent or a lawyer, and then they're pressured into pleading guilty under threat of spending years in a military judicial process. Now, I say this relates to Al-Shifa because the colonial narrative always, and you can look at the British with the IRA, you can look at the position against Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress, is that those who are victims of the occupation have no rights to legitimate struggle. And so the prisoners that Israel are holding overwhelmingly are people that are accused of committing political acts of violence. And that context also bleeds into Israel's narrative about Al-Shifa. Al-Shifa is not really a hospital. Al-Shifa, look, I don't know if you guys have the video, but if you do, you should play it. Israel puts out a video to justify the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital, the most important hospital in Gaza, where you had dozens of children that needed incubators. Israel had knocked out the power supply. You had the most vulnerable patients there. They put out a video, the Israeli Defense Forces, that is this high-tech, three-dimensional rendering, they said, of an underground, what I just call a Hamas Pentagon. And they imply that this is the central facility where Hamas is planning its terror operations. When Israel finally then lays full siege to it, with the backing of the Biden administration and Biden himself, they co-signed all of that. They said that hostages had been held under the hospital. They said that it was used as a command and control center. When Israel finally starts to access the hospital, they take embedded journalists on these propaganda tours. And what they found was essentially nothing of any major significance. They go in and they say, oh, look, we found these rifles behind an MRI machine, which is ridiculous for anyone who knows that the technology of an MRI machine and the magnetism of it. They're all conveniently placed, neatly arranged. There's one Hamas vest with a Hamas logo on it. So that gets ridiculed, and skepticism is expressed even by corporate media outlets that historically print Israel's propaganda as just established fact. So then they finally gain access to a tunnel in the area. They go down there and they say, oh, this tunnel is X number of meters long, and there's a blast-proof door that has a hole so that the Hamas terrorists can fire at us. So we need to take some time before we blow it open, and on the other side is going to be this command and control center. So finally then, last week, they blow the thing open. They go in there, and what do they find? They find three rooms, basically. One looks like a kind of very old school 1980s style exam room from a hospital. There's a sink somewhere in there. There's two toilets. And then you have this utter clown from the IDF who has been made a fool of himself by doing these tours. It's like Geraldo Rivera looking for Al Capone's vault. He's running around saying, aha, there's electricity in here. This is a Hamas command center. Aha, they had an air conditioner in here. You know, the pipes are rusty. Many of the electrical wires aren't even connected. Now, I don't know for a fact that Hamas guys weren't under there. It wouldn't shock me if at some point Hamas did have people under there. But we were told this was like a Hamas Pentagon and that it was so dangerous that it justified laying siege to a hospital filled with the most vulnerable people. This is akin to sort of the George H.W. Bush administration lies about the Iraqis pulling babies from incubators. It's an utter lie. that was co-signed and promoted by President Joe Biden and his administration, and they should be made to answer for this because it wasn't just Al-Shifa. They did it at the Indonesia hospital. They did it at other hospitals. Of course, Hamas has networks of tunnels underneath Gaza, 150 to 300 kilometers by some estimates. Israel is waging a targeted assassination campaign against them, and they live in a confined area waging a guerrilla war. That's not news, but Israel tried to rebrand something that anyone who's followed this already knows and try to make it seem like it's a smoking gun. And in fact, it was a lethal lie.
Jeremy Scahill, I want to thank you for being with us, senior reporter correspondent at The Intercept. We'll link to your pieces on Al-Shifa and Palestinian prisoners at democracynow.org. Coming up, we remember the life and legacy of Pablo Yoruba Guzman, who co-founded the New York chapter of the Young Lords back in 20 seconds. By Hooray for the Riffraff. This is Democracy Now! I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show remembering the life and legacy of Pablo Yoruba Guzman, visionary former Minister of Information of the Young Lords, longtime print and television reporter who's died of a heart attack. In 1969, Guzman co-founded the New York chapter of the predominantly Puerto Rican radical group, the Young Lords, which fought against police brutality, racism, U.S. imperialism, and militarism. The Young Lords also provided health care, child care, and breakfast to impoverished people, most of them Black and Latino. In this clip from December 1969, Pablo Guzman speaks after the Young Lords took over the first Spanish United Methodist Church in East Harlem, which became known as the People's Church.
And it ain't just y'all in this church, you know. It ain't just East Harlem. Remember, we relate to an international struggle. So it may sound ridiculous, but this all links up to what's happening from Vietnam to Puerto Rico to Watts. Don't ever forget that. That without you here, see, our children have had it. What you do here today, and what you do after you leave this church, no matter what happens, whether we get busted, or whether we have to walk out, either way, it's still a victory. Whatever happens on after that is going to be important for the fate of the world, because we're in the belly of the monster, and people all over are waiting for us to take care of business. And I don't like people to be too optimistic, because I'm kind of a pessimist, you know. But remember that no matter what happens, one way or the other, we have won. We have a victory here today. They can never take that away from us. Everybody here, go out, and you go out proud no matter what happens. But this church is ours. This is a people's church.
That's Pablo Yoruba Guzman speaking in 1969. In addition to being joined by Juan, who co-founded the New York chapter of the Young Lords with Yoruba, we're joined by Johanny Fernandez, the author of the award-winning book, The Young Lords, A Radical History. Juan, why don't you introduce this?
Well, Amy, I think one of the things that the people underestimate Pablo, as our Minister of Information, grasped from the start the critical importance for any people's movement of controlling its own narrative, not allowing it to be determined or defined by others. It was he, for example, who launched the Palante radio program on WBAI back in 1970, and who launched and initially supervised as the editor of the Palante newspaper. And as an 18-year-old, he had already studied one of the seminal figures of the 20th century media studies, Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan, and had absorbed McLuhan's theory that all mass media have historically functioned as extensions of the human brain, but that each medium, print, radio, television, does so in a distinct way, has its own language and message, and seeks to directly provoke our emotions. Pablo insisted that in order to control our narrative, we had to tailor our messages to each medium and also to use humor and bravado. He was an extremely funny guy, and he basically captivated the corporate media in many ways. And thanks to his approach, the Lords received perhaps the most sympathetic press coverage of any 1960s revolutionary organization. Pablo Guzman was, in short, the first great public relations expert of the U.S. Latino community.
And Johanna Fernandez, if you can talk about the significance of, he was known then as Yoruba, Pablo Guzman, to the entire New York community for the decades. He was a on-the-street journalist, Juan called him the best street journalist there was in New York, working for all the various networks from CBS to NBC to WNET.
Yeah, and he received two Emmys. He was a street reporter, and he was bold, and he got his boldness from his experience in the Young Lords, that experience around the media theorizing what it meant to be an activist, to engage in creative disruption, and how to use the media to speak to a larger audience, right? Something that activists around the crisis in Gaza are trying to do today. But I think that Pablo got his pizzazz, his humor, from his heritage. His grandfather, Mario Palomino, was in Cuba when he enrolled and applied to the Tuskegee Institute, the first institution of higher education for African Americans in Alabama, and got in and graduated after 4 years. So he was a man of color, a black Cuban, who instilled in Pablo's father a sense of pride in being black and Latino, black and Cuban. Pablo's father took him to hear Malcolm X speak on 125th Street when he was 12 years old. One thing about Pablo was that he was one of the first Afro-Latino people in the media. Before the Young Lords emerged, when you thought about Puerto Ricans in the media or in the public sphere, it was light-skinned Puerto Ricans. And so Pablo brought to the Young Lords a theorization of race in Latin America. And he talked about the influence of colonialism on the psyche of the colonized and the oppressed Latinos who tend to deny their blackness. And part of what the Young Lords did through Pablo Guzman and others was to build common cause with black Americans and accept and be proud of their own blackness. This is a spectacular figure who went to China with a delegation of 70 radicals in 1971, Pablo Guzman, that is. He was one of the people present at the formal announcement of the Rainbow Coalition initiated by Black Panther Fred Hampton in Chicago. And we can go on and on. There really is no time to talk about how significantly important he was as an actor in the history of the 60s.
Juan, you have 30 seconds to wrap up, and then we're going to do this interview in Spanish after the show.
Well, he was just a unique figure in New York City history, in the Latino and the Puerto Rican community. We're all going to miss him, and our condolences to his wife, Debbie, his children, and to his mother, Sally, who was always a big supporter and friend of the Young Lords.
Well, Juan and Johanna, our condolences and to the whole community about the death of Pablo Guzman, Pablo Yoruba Guzman. Johanna Fernandez, Associate Professor of History at the City University of New York's Baruch College, also author of the award-winning book, The Young Lords, A Radical History. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be. featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.